Your glance, Isolde, blinded him too. Out of jealousy, my friend betrayed me to the king whom I betrayed. Tristan's words at the end of Act Two of Wagner's opera Tristan and Isolde, which you've just heard performed here at the Royal Albert Hall and live on Radio 3, the home of the BBC Proms. Violeta Urmana is singing Isolde and Robert Dean Smith, Tristan. Mihoko Fujimura is Frank Gaynor and Kwang Chul-Yun, King Mark. Maelot sung by David Wilson-Johnson and Corvinal by Boaz Daniel. The BBC Symphony Orchestra, led by Sergei Levitin, is conducted by Semyon Bichkov. I said it was semi-staged a little earlier. It isn't really semi-staged, but there is some moving around, confrontation, looks, and all the singers have performed their parts often. In other words, they're not using books. They're very much involved in what they're doing. So there is that feeling of being involved in a real dramatic event, not just any kind of sing-through. Well, Wagner's version of the Tristan story challenged mid-19th century mores and was at odds with religious and social authority, even in the 13th century, where Wagner's medieval source Gottfried von Strasbourg's version was admired for its poetry and pilloried for its suspect morality. For Gottfried, Tristan's passion comes into irreconcilable conflict with his loyalty to the king, his uncle. The lover's bond is absolute and unconditional, which in the medieval world could only be compared with the status of religion. Gottfried replaced the sacred altar with a bed of love, so the lovers are sustained not by a Eucharist of symbolic food and drink, but by a total commitment to sexual passion, a code radically at odds with honour and religion as understood by medieval courtly society. In Wagner's time, most versions of the legend replace this scandalous subversion of marriage and religion with the death of the woman being a just sacrifice, atoning for such an illicit relationship going way beyond conventional morality. Wagner ignored all those watered-down versions in the throes, as he was, of being in love with a married woman, Mathilde von Wesendonck, when he was writing his opera, and then having an adulterous relationship with Cosima von Bülow, the wife of the conductor of the opera's premiere. But Wagner's poem was crucial in persuading the 19th century to rethink its attitude to the Tristan legend. During this second interval here on Radio 3, we've a new commission for the Proms from the poet Lavinia Greenlaw, who's written a sequence of poems inspired by Tristan and Isolde, and more specifically by the theme of vision that runs through the opera. This dreaming sea takes its title from Wagner's opening scene, in which Isolde calls the sea to action, force this dreaming sea from its sleep. It's read by Lavinia Greenlaw and David Seddon.
A mirror. He refuses who I am and fixes his gaze on the simple line of the horizon. To meet me openly would be to face a mirror held up to the sun, so concentrated has this become. Pure beam, I might blind him. This is a voyage he defines. Less than passenger, my only function is to arrive. I say that I am here and refuse my place under canopies. He hides me among company and trusts that protocol will silence me. This ship sails too easily on. He will deliver me without thought of what he has done. Some say I have within me a storm. If he won't turn, I'll wake this dreaming sea and fill this empty air. I'll so mock this helpful breeze that it will prove itself an obliterating gale, and so enrage this dishwater and its tick-tock waves, it will arch and flex like the trapped force it is. This sea will slam its doors. It will spew monstrous eels. Its floor will raise up to break this ship upon its coral spires, to drag it down into vaults that run with black fire. This storm I have within will smash any mirror and blunt any sword. It will break everything down into its smallest pieces, which will sink so deep they lose all meaning. I give my word, he must turn, or this ship will arrive nowhere, carrying nothing.
A telescope. I must keep my thoughts as small and remote as the dry land I can just make out through this glass. How to focus this difficulty? It is an unmapped country. I will record each rise and fall, trace detail, allowing that each moment is, within itself, perfectly clear. I do not need to see more. All that has brought us to this must now be contained. It has already been too long remembered. There is an order to bring to this. The moment at which she was not to be mine. The moment to come when she cannot be mine. And the journey between. I must concentrate on the blue line that even now deepens into green. It will become the point at which she is gone.
A puzzle. I still see the man he has chosen to forget. The man he once was, wounded, adrift, and brought to me as someone else, someone lost. I took him in, as I would any broken thing, and while he slept, spent long hours collecting pieces. Within his armor, he was empty, and without it, seemed not to know his own body. The body I gave back, even after I opened up a memory and saw how his actions fitted my loss. This man had already hurt me. Everything was clear. I knew what I should remember and was myself armoured and ready to end him, and yet, in that moment, his eyes met mine entirely and openly. I did not want to know what I recognized. I did nothing. He went on staring, and even then, I didn't realize that he was taking measure of me as an image, an offering.
A spell. If nothing else, I will face her now, safe in the nearness of parting. I step with her into this corner, alone. I drink the potion she offers, because I will drink anything if its intention is what's truly in her heart. Life or death, I drink to prove that I know what happened and what I have done. I can say it now. I let myself be saved, only to give her away.
If nothing else, I will make him feel the pity I once took on him, such pity that I no longer knew my own pain. If nothing else, let us drink to the end of all feeling. A curtain is falling. We have met in our ending.
A curtain is falling. The world is ink and velvet. My blood plumes, my heart bursts like the fullest rose. There is no room for this within me, no room within who I know myself to be. I have taken in what I cannot contain, and I am breaking.
If this is death, then it's only a breaking down into light and air. A new beginning. I meant us to drink knives that would tear our hearts to shreds and end this. Instead, my body pours like grain towards him, and my eyes strain towards the deepest core of him. Otherwise, nothing. What power turned this lock? The air crowds in on us in wonder and leaves no space. All that exists is this thing we have made.
Order back! Echo!
The ship is in port. We must escape what we have made and step into the light to greet those who wait. For their sake, their faith, we must some other self compose, a poor version, so that I can be seen to give what must be seen to be taken.
A torch. How to wait when ready and alone? This summer dusk refuses to soften, spangling white and silver while the days rose and gold are long gone. The forest is too clear, its paths too open. I must wait for those who watch over me to go deeper among the trees. Let the forest lose them. Here can still be seen from there. Let dusk blacken. I could wait if I could see him also waiting, but the air does not appear to contain him. It is without charge, undisturbed. I fear he has forgotten or does not dare, and then I fear he will appear too soon and will not heed the torch's warning. But I want him. Put out the flame. It quibbles and jabs, a petty flicker that reminds me I can never be sure of the dark's darkness. I am never truly safe, never truly alone. Such a small flame. It burns as question, interruption, complication, hesitation. Put it out and let him be here. I will make a night for us without dimension, a night without regulation in which the planets slip their bounds and time drifts, and whatever matter we burn becomes what we have of a world of our own. Put out the flame. Let us leave this place to its measured decline, its sputtering weakness dulling to ash. Put out the flame.
In a dark room. Is it really her my fingers describe? I thought her made of emeralds and gold, silk and brocade, pearl buttoned and petal stitched. What I have in my hands, so live, so changeable, barely graspable, is a storm cloud. What brushes my face, as soft and strong as the tip of an eagle's wing? The length of her hair, which is always spoken of as red and tightly braided. Who knew what those braids contained? This is what it means to meet out of sight, out of our own sight, to know what can be known most truly through closed eyes, not emeralds and gold, but feathers and cloud. I did not know that what lay within her was so free, so strong, an eagle, a storm.
Desire so free, so strong, that we consume earth, moon, and sun. Beyond us, there is nothing, no one. He casts off his name and I mine. He is a dark star that draws me in, enveloping.
Glare. The sun is breaking down the door, filling the room with jangle and glitter. I am as scoured as a snail torn from its shell. I see nothing. My eyes are too wide, like those of a young owl caught in the forest's net and forced into light. I should have been gone, and left her to wake in such a manner that would not condemn her. But why hide this? It is the truth. As it is true to say, I owe this man, her husband, so much that I gave him what I wanted most. But she was not to be given, nor was my heart to be stopped. So we have fallen out of our days and have destroyed our names. Having no more words, they draw their swords. I will not move.
gravity. Voices rise and fall, like a dull and distant sea. I am tired of this, and so concentrated upon him that any other hand on my arm, however beseeching, weighs too heavily. To keep us here, you try to cut him down. If you cut him down, I beg you, cut me. Cut us free.
Delirium. Where? Not there, not beside her. Falling, taken, travelling, another sea, another country. Here. Where? I have lain for so long among myself in a place I did not put myself, under a wall that keeps me out. Or does it keep me in? Is it my own skin? The world is a wall from which I am falling. The world is an edge I'm travelling. I am somewhere I cannot tell, and do not know where or how I have to be. This is not day, or night, or death, or sleep, or land, or sea. I keep stumbling on a piece that is missing. The one thing I can name in this hell is she. I did not die. I drank too deeply. I know this song. It lets itself down inside my mind like a rope spooling into a well. I hear it again. The one clear thing. I start to climb. The song raises me up as if its notes were links in a chain. And the song that was the rope and then the chain becomes a place I can name. I have not woken, nor can I say where I've been, but this is my faraway home. I grew up inside this song, empty days under a simple sun, a world waiting to be drawn. I wore every crown. The sky was a bowl of blue, the forest crackled with wolves, and the caves breathed dragons. The path between the rocks was full of clues, and the sea was every story, every beginning, every end, and every dream. Let me rest in the song, unthinking and at home, till she comes. She who is every beginning, every end, and every dream, every story, every sea. Dazzle. And now she is here, and free to be here, and I free to turn towards her. A man of wounds, who asks forgiveness for his injuries, and moves to meet her openly, even as he leaves himself, even as he pours forth all that he has made himself contain. For so long.
Vision. I watched the moon rise. At first its light crept over the top of the ridge. Then the moon slid out from behind the mountains. Nothing moved, not the moon, not the mountains. Yet moment by moment space opened up between them. In such a manner is he leaving. With each breath, a little more of him. Death is this breaking down, a slow dissolution into light and air. He's still here, but becoming with each breath everywhere. My love, you are now what you have always been, as miraculous a presence as dust drawn up from the earth to dance in the sun, seen as one thing by one person in a moment of passing. And the clearest thing in my life has been to see and be seen by this one person. I refuse this. He is not gone. He is in all that floats and spins, and I will break myself down into light, into air. Dust drawn up from the earth to dance in the sun, seen as one thing by one person in a moment of passing.
Lavinia Greenlaw and David Seddon were reading This Dreaming Sea by Lavinia Greenlaw. The producer was Emma Harding. Well, welcome back briefly to the Royal Albert Hall. We're live on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, as we are for every concert in the season. And if you've just joined us, we're between Acts 2 and 3 of Wagner's opera Tristan and Isolde, in which the BBC Symphony Orchestra is being conducted by Semyon Bychkov. The action continues in about 10 minutes or so. And throughout this year, when we're broadcasting operas by our anniversary composers, Wagner, Verdi and Britten, we're giving you the opportunity to download an opera guide devoted to each opera. Here's our Tristan guide, which begins with the Wagner specialist, John Dethridge.
Wagner did not plan it beforehand. He suddenly decided to write Tristan in 1854. So in the middle of The Ring, he suddenly decides to write Tristan. He realised, with the help of Schopenhauer, that what he'd set up in terms of his music dramatic project was taking him down unexpected paths, musically and dramatically. This had deep meaning for him.
Tristan and Isolde is an Arthurian tale, and like so many Arthurian tales, comes from the Celtic world. There's an unearthly light on the story. Something uncanny is going on, and there's an atmosphere heavy with doom. Tristan and Isolde fall in love as a result of a love potion when they are mutually antagonistic to each other as a result of Tristan killing Isolde's uncle. And the potion carries all before it. They actually seem to go mad. They sweep aside honour, morality, marriage vows. Isolde is already married to the King of Cornwall. Reason itself departs from
at the very outset of this work, we have this swooning, yearning cello, followed by the Tristan chord, as one refers to it. And this Tristan chord is chromatic, and it's just a sequence of notes where you don't only feel a sense of profound longing. It's a motive that seeks closure. It's looking for closure.
He fell in love with the wife of his patron, Otto Wesendonck, Mathilde Wesendonck. There's no evidence that she fell in love with him.
He insisted, possibly correctly, that it was all completely platonic. He described this affair in an exalted and romantic manner. And of course, his shock and horror when Mina, his wife, put a much more commonplace interpretation on this relationship and insisted that it stopped. And, of course, it all appears in this opera.
Wagner certainly did see the biographical relevance of this when he started, but the more he worked on it, the more he realised that it wasn't about, you know, petty jealousies. It became a much more philosophical piece, musically more complex piece, but it's not really a love story in the normal sense of the word. He's understanding this in terms of Schopenhauer, who believed that the philosophy of human beings in the world should be really all about getting rid of these fatal, warlike, aggressive, sexual instincts. Then in the second act, we have famous love duet after a lot of philosophizing about their relationship, incidentally, which tries the patience of some Wagnerians and indeed Wagner himself, who recommended cuts in the second act.
This love between Tristan and Isolde, which on some level, even when you feel that at that great moment, the climax of the second act, you think there will be closure, and it is brutally interrupted with the arrival of King Mark and his soldiers.
There's a long scene with King Mark, which is one of the most important things in the opera, because King Mark basically asks Tristan why he decided to betray him. And Tristan gives an answer saying, "You cannot understand this because I am in an emotional place that you can never experience." And then he asks Isolde, "Do you want to come with me to this place?" She says yes. Melot, one of Tristan's rivals at court, then tries to attack Tristan, and Tristan deliberately falls on the sword to create the wound. So he's almost committing suicide at the end of the second act. Then the third act is all about Tristan's confrontation with his own past and with his state of being and his suffering from the wound which won't heal. So this is a man who knows he's going to die, basically. And this is where the most extraordinary music of Wagner occurs. It does take music to an extreme that opera composers, opera audiences had never experienced before.
Richard Wagner opened, in some ways, this Pandora's box of there's no home, there's no tonal centre anymore. And, of course, this is where, after Richard Wagner, you had Alban Berg, you had Arnold Schoenberg, you had Webern. It opened up, quite frankly, as we know it, modern music.
The influence is not only musical, but psychological. I think the fact that someone has the courage to really go deeply into the man-woman relationship, to the extent that a couple need somehow to escape from this world to experience each other, a utopian love that is beyond understanding somehow, and a degree to which, through art, one can delve into the psychological makeup of a human being and then two human beings as they interrelate. This just knocked the world for six.
It quite literally needs those 5 hours, this whole epic story, for the penultimate bar of this work, where the oboe takes us higher, and finally, and incredibly poignantly, the interval goes up and it's home. It's found closure. And in this case, the closure is death, or what we believe to be death. What is there then?
In that Radio 3 Opera Guide to Wagner's Tristan and Isolde, you heard the voices of the conductors Donald Runicles and Antonio Papano, the historian Sarah Lenton, and the Wagner scholar John Dethridge. And if you like, you can download that podcast and all the other Radio 3 Opera Guides so far available via the podcasts link, which you'll find on the Radio 3 homepage. Tristan and Isolde remains Wagner's greatest attempt to forge a drama of the soul. External events disappear as Wagner creates a theatre of pure inwardness, inscape rather than landscape, inner states rather than outer gestures. Tristan and Isolde do not act, they feel. Words from an essay by Arthur Homburg on the opera whose final act and inevitable resolution we're about to hear. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley, where the audience is drifting back into the auditorium for the last lap of Tristan in this semi-stage, we might call it, production, with Robert Dean Smith and Violetta Urmana in the title roles and the BBC Symphony Orchestra conducted by Semyon Bychkov. It's almost impossible to believe that Wagner finished Tristan in 1859. In it, he wanted to proclaim unquenchable yearning, sexual passion, the eventual relinquishing of that passion in death as a powerful replacement for religion. And to do that, he had to deepen drastically the way he used his musical resources. He began with his use of leitmotifs, which had started off in his operas as snatches of music, symbolically representing an object like a sword or a spear. Progressively, Wagner used them in his work in a less straightforward way. In Tristan, he went further than ever. Their meanings become very elusive, with the exception of just two, representing death and day, the former longed for as a love death, the latter railed against for its ability to reveal the lovers to the outside world. Elsewhere in this opera, motifs blend with each other in seemingly endless flexibility of themselves and their associations. And if the motifs become abstract in Tristan, so at times does the music itself. There are moments, particularly during the love duet in Act Two, when Wagner composes so singers overlap, words are extremely extended, and the orchestration under them is opulent. He can't have meant the text to come across in such places. It's not irrelevant, but it's been reabsorbed into the orchestral fabric of the music. And that music demonstrates an unprecedented expansion of harmonic possibilities, right from the very start of the prelude with that so-called Tristan chord, which Wagner only resolves, as we'll hear tonight, at the very end of the opera. Every element of the work is geared to the generation and intensification of tension, tension caused by longed-for fulfilment. And the strange unresolved chord progressions by which Wagner achieves this mean that it's entirely justified, I think, to call Tristan the harbinger of the new music of the 20th century. Wagner saves the most extreme chromaticism, as we've heard, for Tristan and Isolde themselves, close to insanity at times, obsessively neurotically absorbed in each other and themselves. On the opposite side of the coin, the betrayed King Mark, even the betrayer Melot, reflecting the normal values of courtly society, are given much more straightforward music. And Corvinal, it may be Tristan's servant, but as we're about to hear in Act Three, while Tristan's music is as tortured and complex as the man himself in his wounded agony, Corvinal's is foursquare, like the loyal, down-to-earth man he is. As the final act begins, Tristan, brought back to his ancestral home in Brittany by his servant Corvinal, is lying unconscious. A shepherd, the tenor Andrew Staples, plays a sad tune on his pipe and asks Corvinal what's wrong with his master. Corvinal doesn't answer, but tells the shepherd to watch for an approaching ship. Tristan wakes, and Corvinal says he has sent for Isolde. In his feverish state, Tristan believes he sees Isolde's ship, but the shepherd is still playing his sad tune. Tristan's despairing mind runs back obsessively over his life. His longing for death and yearning to live become one. He remembers the first meeting with Isolde and curses the love potion before collapsing. When he revives, he again thinks he sees Isolde's ship, and this time the shepherd's happy tune tells him it's true. He brusquely orders Corvinal to go and meet her, and in his delirium tears the bandage from his wound so he can be reunited with Isolde on the point of death. He whispers her name and dies in her arms. She falls unconscious. The shepherd announces a second ship, on which Corvinal sees King Mark and Melot. Thinking they've come to fetch Isolde, Corvinal stabs Melot and is himself killed, dying at his master Tristan's feet. In fact, Brangaena has told the king how she changed the potions, and he has come to unite Tristan and Isolde. He's overwhelmed by the death and destruction in front of him. Isolde wakes and gazes at Tristan. She sings the Liebestod, more transfiguration than love death, before sinking onto his body, mystically united with him at last. A lot of programmes being used as fans being used as fans. And you heard the promenaders still enthusiastically telling us how much they've collected for musical charities, and I'm sure those coffers will be swelled when the audience leaves the hall tonight in an hour and a half's time or so. Semyon Bychkov looks as though he's just going for a walk in the park, hardly a hair out of place, hardly perspiring, and yet he's putting an awful lot into this, as of course are all the musicians in front of him. And they, the BBC Symphony Orchestra, all seated and ready to go, just waiting for the soloist to begin the act, together with conductor. Cameras moving along. Don't forget, this is being filmed by BBC4 Television, and you can see it on Sunday, the 1st of September. But now, here they are, Andrew Staples, the Shepherd, Corvinal Boaz Daniel, Tristan, Robert Dean Smith, and Semyon Bychkov, who brings the BBC Symphony Orchestra to its feet. Takes the hand of Sergei Levitin, tonight's leader of the BBC Symphony Orchestra. So now, we're all ready here in the Royal Albert Hall for the final act of Wagner's Tristan and Isolde.
Thank you. Schiff noch auf der See. Eine andere Weise hört es nun an, so lustig als ich sie nur kann. Und sag auch ehrlich, alter Freund, was hat's mit unserem Herrn? Los! Fragen. Du kannst doch nie erfahren, eifrig spät, und siehst du ein Schiff, so stille, luftig und hell.
Das Volk. Thank you. Ein Schiff zu sehen.
Herzen hin, erwiesen Brand. zu weinen. Bist du nun tot? Lebst du noch? Hat dich der Fluch entführt? Wonne, nein, erregt sich, verliebt, wie sanft er die Lippen rührt. Es naht noch heut, es
klang mir so immen.
Oh, Norman, sehr gestorben.
Schiff.
in the surging swell, in the ringing sound, in the vast wave of the world's breath, to drown, to sink unconscious, supreme bliss. Isolde's final words at the end of her Liebestod, her transfiguring love death, sung by Violetta Urmana, embraced by Semyon Bychkov and given that huge yell by the audience here in the Royal Albert Hall. And that one for Robert Dean Smith, our Tristan. In that final act of Wagner's Tristan and Isolde, as I say, Isolde sung by Violetta Urmana, Tristan by Robert Dean Smith. Wang Chul Yun making his proms debut was King Mark. Mihoko Fujimura, Brangena, another proms debut. Boaz Daniel, another proms debut, Corvinal. Andrew Staples sang the Shepherd, David Wilson Johnson Maylott, Edward Price the Steersman. BBC Symphony Orchestra led by Sergei Levitin. Performance conducted by Semyon Bychkov, who brings the BBC Symphony Orchestra to its feet. And the soloists high up beside the organ. Koronge player Alison Teal, the sad voice before his older ship is seen. That yearning solo. It's also fascinating that the cor anglais at the very end, when the final resolution comes, Wagner doesn't have the cor anglais playing the resolution. The final chord is not played by the cor anglais. It never resolves. And the wooden trumpet, the tarugato, played by Martin Robertson underneath the organ here in the Royal Albert Hall. What a colossal scene that is for both the principals, both the named characters, as it were, particularly any Tristan going through every emotion in the book to the verge of losing his mind in the first part of that final act, and to pace himself to leave enough petrol in the tank for act three. Well, he'll be back, Robert Dean Smith. He'll be back in this hall tomorrow week, the 4th of August at 6, to sing Tannhäuser with the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Don Runicles. And then Bychkov returns to the BBC Symphony Orchestra for Britain's War Requiem, I think. And as for Violetta Urmana, leading the procession back onto the stage, well, next month she's singing this role at the Schleswig-Holstein Festival, and it's a major staple of her next season in Vienna, Madrid and Paris. The Symphony Orchestra, well, I should think they'll have a nice lie-in on Sunday. I really hope they will. It is hot, hot, hot in the hall, but they've done wonderfully, wonderfully, wonderfully well, as you can hear the applause here in the hall. But they'll be back here on Thursday evening. Thursday evening's prom at 7:30 with Oliver Nussen showing the musical reach of the orchestra. Hence Peter Serkin making his prom debut, astonishingly, in two Stravinsky works, Concerto for Piano and Wind and Movements, and Tippett's glorious Second Symphony. Don't forget, you can listen again to this Tristan performance for a week via the BBC Radio 3 website. Hope you've enjoyed our epic journey through Wagner's Tristan. The audience here at the Royal Albert Hall clearly has. And if you enjoyed that journey through Wagner's ultimate glorification of love, you'll want to join us here on Radio 3 the even earlier time of 4:30 tomorrow afternoon for a world finally redeemed by love in Götterdämmerung, the Twilight of the Gods, the final installment of Wagner's Ring Cycle. Performed here at the BBC Proms by the Staatskapelle Berlin, conducted by Daniel Barenboim, Nina Stemmer as Brunhilde, Andreas Schager as Siegfried, Michael Petrenko as Hagen. More wonderful music making in store at the BBC Proms tomorrow. David Wilson Johnson's Maylott, he's coming back onto the platform. And a very bouncing Corvinal, Boaz Daniel. Mihoko Fujimura, Brangena, who did more acting than anybody, really, and it's that sort of a part. And you can hear what people felt of it, what was a heartfelt performance, extraordinary performance, drew us into the story at exactly those crucial moments. Hwang Chul-yoon. Well, I'm sure he won't mind me saying he's not the tallest of gentlemen, but what a voice. I'm told BBC Symphony Orchestra is in love with him. Robert Dean Smith. Tristan. Well, he's got 8 days before he has to assay Tannhäuser. No doubt, lots of rehearsals in the meantime. And I think we should wait to hear the roar for Isolde too. Violetta Urmana joining the soloists here in the Royal Albert Hall. An elated South Kensington, you might say. Time for me to hand you across Hyde Park to Jonathan Swain, waiting at Broadcasting House to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening. Jonathan.
Martin, thank you very much. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall. And what Wagnerian riches the Proms are bringing us this year, as Martin was saying. Every Proms available to listen to again online via the Radio 3 website, anytime you like, for 7 days from the broadcast. And just one more statistic for you. The closure of the Liebestod in Tristan rarely fails because, as one scholar's claimed, the opening preludes, searching Tristan chord, looking for that closure, reappears during the course of Tristan 1,400 times. Well, the live music making continues here on Radio 3 in just under an hour with another of the weekend's visits to WOMAD 2013, the Globe's leading festival of world music, live from the festival site in Charlton Park in Wiltshire. So expect Mongolian throat singers, the Barcelona-based rumba band La Pegatina, and a good many other acts at the top of their game. That's all from a quarter past 11 here on Radio 3. Before it, a symphony by a Frenchman, Ernest Chausson, who took his wife to Wagner's Bayreuth Festival on their honeymoon. Amazingly, the marriage survived, and his symphony is saturated with Wagner in general, and Tristan in particular. That's in 10 minutes' time. First of all, here to Venice, where Wagner famously died in 1883. This is Kein deutscher Himmel, No German Sky, by the French composer Gérard Pesson. It's a transcription he made in the 1990s for unaccompanied choir of the Adagietto from Mahler's Fifth Symphony. Mahler's original for strings and harp was, of course, made famous by Visconti's film Death in Venice, based on Thomas Mann's novella of the same name. Visconti's film suggesting, with a little help from Dirk Bogarde and his makeup team, that it was Mahler who died in Venice. Poetic license, of course. Well, the words are a love song to the many aspects of Venice taken from texts by the German poet August von Platen, but the music's the thing, as indeed is this performance of it. Laurence Equilbé conducting the Accentus Chamber Choir.
Thank you.
Mahler's Fifth Symphony Adagietto, transcribed by Gérard Pesson for unaccompanied choir and called Kein Deutscher Himmel, No German Sky. The singers were the Accentus Chamber Choir, conducted by Laurence Equilbet, and the solo choir member responsible for the unearthly beauty and perfection of those stratospheric descants was soprano Solange Anorgas. What followed here on Radio 3 has promised the Chausson Symphony. Chausson may have been besotted with Wagner's music, but he wasn't alone in that in 1890s France. More to the point, he was probably César Franck's most gifted pupil, and there are likenesses between the Chausson Symphony and Franck's better-known one. It's in three movements, and there are parallels in the way the themes are developed and returned to. On the other hand, though, the passionate flights in the Chausson belong to a man in his early 30s. Franck was in his mid-60s when he wrote his symphony. Also, there are none of Franck's organ sonorities anywhere in Chausson's wonderfully varied open-air orchestration. And that most perceptive of writers on music, Wilfried Mellers, has pointed out that Chausson's lyrical line, unlike Franck's, has, as he put it, an almost Berliozian power and span. And then there's Wagner. Well, on one level, you could take Chausson's symphony as a kind of Wagnerian synthesis. We could be here all day on that. How about magic fire music in the first movement, storm and horseback ride in the third, and Tristan just about all over the place? Jan-Pascal Tortelier conducts the BBC Philharmonic. Jan-Pascal Tourtellier conducting the BBC Philharmonic in Chausson's symphony, his only symphony, a piece first heard in Paris in 1891. Well, to follow it here on BBC Radio 3, a touch of French farce from Jean Francais. This music, written in 1947 in honour of an exclusive Parisian brasserie and called L'Heure du Berger, Shepherd's Hour. The performers here, seven of the best chefs in Paris, including pianist Pascal Roger.
Thank you.
Shepherd's Hour, L'Heure du Berger, ending there in the Music Hall, a piece written in 1947 by Jean Francais. The players were Catherine Quentin, flute, Maurice Bourg, oboe, Michel Portal, clarinet, André Cazalet, horn, Amaury Vallée, bassoon, and Pascal Roger playing the piano. Well, later tonight, Radio 3 Through the Night sets off with a recent Brahms concert from the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra, the Third and Fourth Symphonies, and the double concerto for violin, cello and orchestra. That's from 1 o'clock. But now, with the time at 11:15, we continue our weekend of live broadcasts from the 2013 WOMAD Festival. So it's over to the festival site in Charlton Park in Wiltshire, where we join Mary-Anne Kennedy.
Welcome back to WOMAD Live. We might be a bit damp around the edges, but as you can probably hear in the background there, the festival is in full flight tonight, and we're bringing you some choice highlights, interviews, live sets, an exclusive session, and from our vantage point here in the Radio 3 truck backstage, a unique behind-the-scenes perspective. From the sight earlier on of Save the Arctic's enormous furry polar bear being carried off to drier quarters to, well, this. One of our stage guests leaving us in no doubt as to what he was about earlier on. And if you thought that was fairly full-on energy, well, you'll be able to hear them later on in Top Gear. Josh Payton, a.k.a. the Reverend Payton, his backstage rider, apparently requests 100 rounds of ammunition, preferably of American origin. But then I suppose that would go down differently in Indiana. As I said, we'll hear from Moore, shooting from the hip, I think, before the end of tonight's show. So, the BBC WOMAD highlights are coming in thick and fast. Maybe you heard Lucy Duran at lunchtime, or you've been following us online. Get in touch and let us know what your showstopper has been or your new discovery for this year's festival at BBC Radio 3 with the WOMAD13 hashtag. Of course, we may yet change your mind, blow your mind even, with tonight's choice lineup. It includes throat singers Hunhur II, Trinidadian steel pan legend Fimber Bravo, Swiss Ethiopiana from the fabulous Imperial Tiger Orchestra, and of course, Malian superstar Rokia Traoré. Well, you heard our Radio 3 audience in the background there in very fine form, and Lucy Duran is backstage watching them enjoy the last act on the Radio 3 stage tonight, undaunted by the rain, and they're being regaled by a band making their festival debut. Lucy, a bit of rumba, a bit of sound system roots, a leg up I know from Manu Chao. What all goes into this Catalan mix?
Well, I guess you might call it new generation rumba catalana in the style of, well, the old veteran of rumba catalana, Peret, then José Brujo. But these guys they're just really, really high energy, and they mix a lot of Latin American music in with the rumba. They actually call it urban rumba. There are seven of them, five of them are from Barcelona. There are two French guys as well, and they have really, really hilarious dance routines, and they're really getting the crowd going. It's just so exciting because it's rainy, as you know, and yet they've really got everyone terribly excited and dancing and following their dance routines. So here we go with La Pegatina.
Peluqueros de ascensores, habituales de batalla, donde no se va a ganar. Somos uñas, somos carne, y viendo el caos en un mismo paladar. Sobresalto, me despierto en el asfalto, a mi lado una botella que no puedo recordar. Somos uñas, somos carne, viviendo el caos.
No!
con una boca se me cura el miedo a dejarme ver. Lléname de veneno, sacúdeme la conciencia, atrápame con tu genio. Lléname de veneno, tengo muy mala cara, mi mira si yo no puedo. ¡Ahí va! Calculadora, y que vas a amar cuando te echo de menos. Y me da igual que me avisen de tu delirio, si con un poco yo me alivio del miedo a dejar de ser. Lléname de veneno, sacúdeme la conciencia, atrápame con tu genio. Lléname de veneno, tengo muy mala cara, y mira si yo no puedo. Chúpame la sangre,
chúpame,
cómeme por dentro,
cómeme,
gátame en mi salsa,
gátame,
súbete a lo que llevo,
que sube,
chúpame la sangre,
chúpame,
cómeme por dentro,
cómeme,
gátame en mi salsa,
gátame,
súbete a lo que llevo, chúpame la sangre,
chúpame,
cómeme por dentro,
cómeme,
gátame en mi salsa,
gátame,
súbete a lo que llevo. fiesta, no hacían falta transición. Ellas están sin vida, ya no queda la visión. Al caerse el proceso, ve cuando queda yo con Ana. La rumba con la trampera, y ahora no cumpliría para que soca. In our fourth album, Eureka, Eureka, and we're also celebrating these 10 years old of the band. 10 years, 700 concerts in with England. I think it's 17 countries. And this song is about a girl that used to be our friend. Now she's not, and we sing this song for her.